Kane braced himself on the tabletop. He leaned over it, hanging his head down, trying his best not to throw up. The few shots of Popskull he had downed in Boontown percolated in his stomach like lava, threatening to erupt in his throat.
It's damn fortunate the auto-sequence receptors registered your patterns a millisecond before the others came.
Kane lifted his head, blinking back the sweat flowing from his hairline and cutting runnels in the layer of mud caked on his face. Foul water dripped slowly from his clothing, beading on the varnished tabletop. Rauch lay in a fetal position on the table. Kane raised a trembling hand to his perspiration-pebbled brow.
What do you mean?
Bridget, Grant, and Domi tried to return here at the same time you and Beth Lee initiated the transit cycle. The two carrier waves intersected and overlapped for a micro-instant. The timing was in your favor.
Oh, yeah. I feel favored.
DeFore and her aide Auerbach entered the anteroom. Auerbach rolled a gurney behind him. DeFore's dark brown eyes studied both Kane and Rauch before settling on Rauch as the person requiring immediate attention. Bending over her, DeFore timed her pulse at throat and wrist, peeled back an eyelid, listened to her respiration. Kane pushed himself back from the table. His headache and nausea ebbed a bit, although he still felt rubbery-kneed.
What about Baptiste and the others?
Their transponders still show strong readings, but their heart rates and blood pressure are a little elevated.
They're all right. They'll try again. Their unit will automatically reset itself in about 10 minutes.
DeFore looked up, her full lips compressed in disapproval.
Rauch is in a mild state of shock, mild cardiac arrhythmia. Auerbach, please put her on the gurney and take her to the dispensary. We need to get her heart rate under control.
Auerbach gently lifted Rauch onto the gurney and wheeled her out of the room. DeFore regarded Kane with a cold, critical eye.
How about you, Kane? How are you feeling?
Lousy, but I'll get by.
You probably look, and smell worse than you feel. Ugh.
Kane didn't feel up to responding to the woman's acerbic observation regarding his appearance and odor. She didn't disguise her dislike of him, or rather, what he represented to her. In her eyes, as a former magistrate, he embodied the strutting arrogance of Ville law enforcement, glorying in his baron-sanctioned power to deal death indiscriminately. She also believed that because of his magistrate conditioning, he was unable to reconcile his past with his present, and the psychological conflict had him teetering on the brink of nervous collapse. Therefore, Kane couldn't be trusted. DeFore had presented her diagnosis and prognosis to Lakesh, who had refused to act on it, so she wasn't particularly happy with him either.
I know you couldn't care less, but you need to visit DCAM and get out of those wet rags.
Kane only nodded. He had already figured out that for himself. Though the bayou held no dangerous residual radiation, the water he had waded through was probably contaminated with all sorts of chemical toxins. He began to ask her to keep him apprised of Rauch's condition, but the buxom, bronze-skinned doctor spun smartly on her heel, presenting him with the intricate French braid at the back of her ash-blonde head. As she marched away, Kane glared at the braid a moment before turning to Lakesh.
If they're not back here in a few minutes, I'm going after them.
I figured you would say that. Let's give them a little while. For now, you should follow the doctor's orders. I think she may appreciate it.
Yeah. If I don't, she'll probably use barbed wire the next time she has to stitch me up. But I'll wait a bit longer.
Out in the corridor, Grant and Bridget listened to the stealthy footfalls of the point man approaching from around the corner. Both held their blasters ready, though Grant felt Bridget's choice of arms to be so ineffectual against polycarbonate body armor she might as well have brandished a slingshot. Not only would the .32-caliber rounds not penetrate the magistrate's exoskeletons, but the targets wouldn't even feel the impacts. As a former mag, Grant knew all of the armor's weak points, and they were exceptionally difficult to penetrate. After a recent encounter with Cobaltville enforcers, he took pains to load his Sin Eater's clip with armor-piercing rounds taken from the Cerberus arsenal. They were of pre-dark manufacture, since AP rounds had been outlawed during the unification. For that matter, any kind of blaster, even home-forged muzzle loaders, in the hands of anyone other than magistrates was a capital offense. Grant didn't want to engage in a firefight. Although the mags didn't outnumber the Cerberus team, they definitely outgunned them. Aside from their Sin Eaters, they carried Copperheads, wicked stripped-down autoblasters capable of firing all of their 15 4.85mm rounds in seconds. Domi had no firearm at all. Grant had prevailed on her not to carry her preferred weapon, a .45 caliber Detonix Combat Master. Still recovering from her shoulder injury and subsequent surgery, her slight frame didn't have the strength to handle its recoil. Besides, he hadn't envisioned a situation where she would need it. He should have known better, Grant sourly told himself. None of the missions he had undertaken since joining the Cerberus Exiles had adhered to plan, no matter how intricately they had been constructed. Straining his ears, he heard the faint squeak of polycarbonate joints and the slight scuff of treaded boot soles on the floor. To Grant, the point man sounded as if he was more than nervous, but he didn't hazard a peek around the corner. He kept his eyes on the motion detector, watching the green dot that represented the mag sliding over the small LCD screen toward the center position. He tensed, waiting and listening. When he estimated the point man was less than 6 feet away from the bend in the corridor wall, he made his move, swiftly and smoothly. Leaning out around the corner, Grant led with his Sin Eater. The magistrate was closer than he calculated, barely 4 feet away. The exposed lower portion of his face showed his mouth twisting in shock.
Boo.
The round penetrated the red duty badge affixed to the left pectoral, punching a hole through the 9-spoked wheel insignia. The magistrate flailed backward as he fell, a geyser of bright arterial blood squirting up from the perforation in his badge. Grant ducked back around the corner and consulted the motion detector. A pair of pulsing dots appeared at the far edge of the LCD.
Shit, here they come.
The copperhead stuttered, sending a hailstorm of lead spattering against the walls. Grant turned his back, hunching his head between his shoulders so the wide collar of his coat would offer some protection for the back of his head. Bridget crouched down, grimacing at the racket and the astringent, sweetish odor of cordite. A ricocheting bullet plucked at Grant's coat sleeve. The mags seemed determined to empty their subguns, but Grant didn't sense they did so out of fear. Rage drove them. The dry snapping of firing pins striking empty chambers replaced the double trip hammering and the shriek of ricochets.
You fucking assassin! You slag-ass traitor! You ain't walking away from this!
Think you can chill a baron and live to laugh about it? It won't happen, you bastard! You hear me? It won't happen!
Grant's and Bridget's eyes met, widening in confused astonishment.
What are you stoops talking about?
Bridget, shut up. Now they know there is more than one of us down here.
He had wanted the mags to think they had cornered only one man. Bridget and her Mauser weren't much in the way of backup, but they were better than nothing. The sound of the female voice seemed to surprise the magistrates, then galvanized them into even greater heights of anger.
You got the woman herself with you? The fucking bitch that Joe Baron Ragnar?
You stoops are fused out. We don't know anything about you, Baron.
He waited for the mag's reaction to his words of denial. He didn't have to wait long. The magistrates charged down the corridor. Grant pushed Bridget ahead of him toward the open door of the Mattrans control room. He wasn't about to stand his ground and exchange fire with a pair of Berserk mags, AP rounds or not. Chances were he might get one of them, but chances were far greater that one of them would get him. They reached the doorway and Bridget hastily keyed in the close code. As the portal slid shut, at least a dozen bullets struck it, dimpling the metal. Fearfully, Domi peered around the open door of the jump chamber.
We're safe in here, right?
I'm sure they've been briefed on the entry codes. They can get in here if they want to.
And they really want to.
Even if we can't make a jump, we can hold them off in the chamber. They probably don't know about the gateways at all. Certainly not about the security lock code. And they can't shoot through the armor glass.
No, but they can starve us out. Or call in reinforcements with high explosives and blow our asses out of there.
I can always enter the destination code for an alternate unit. Jump luck.
The blaster fire stopped. Grant glanced at the vanadium door. The mags had unleashed their emotions and were probably discussing strategy on the other side of it.
I doubt we'll have more than one chance to get out of here. Once the mags get in, we'll be stuck in the chamber.
Whatever we're going to do, let's do it!
Cerberus, then.
The three people entered the gateway, Bridget pausing momentarily to punch in the lock code and ID encryption. As Grant sealed the jump chamber, he heard the pneumatic hissing of the sec door at the control room wall. He stayed where he was, head pressed against the wall, listening. The humming drone arose. The hexagons shimmered and danced with silver. Outside the chamber, the blaster fire began anew. Bullets smashed themselves into shapeless blobs, black against the red of the armor glass walls. Grant stepped back, wondering briefly if this situation qualified as a one percenter.
Activity on the unit in Redoubt Tango. A dematerialization.
Kane glanced toward the brown-tinted armorglass enclosing the jump chamber and waited for it to do something. When it didn't, he cast an impatient, questioning glance toward Lakesh.
You know traversing the quantum pathways isn't always instantaneous. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
Kane didn't reply, but he knew from experience that Matt Tren's jumping occasionally resulted in minor temporal anomalies, like arriving at a destination 3 seconds before the Origin jump initiator had actually engaged. Lakesh had stated more than once that the nature of time couldn't be measured or accurately perceived in the quantum stream. That brief temporal dilation was the primary reason over Project Whisper's Operation Kronos had used reconfigured gateway units in their time-traveling experiments. Bright light flashed behind the armaglass, swelling in intensity and in tandem with the hurricane noise. Within seconds, the light and sound faded. Kane grabbed the door handle, ignoring the weak jolt of static electricity shooting through his fingers, and wrenched up on it. Through the curling fingers of dissipating white mist, he saw two blaster bores pointing up at his head. The tense, grim faces of Grant and Bridget appeared behind them. Their tight expressions almost immediately went slack with relief, and they lowered their weapons.
What's with the guns?
Sorry. Couldn't see the color of the armaglass for a couple of seconds. Thought the DMAT cycle might have failed and we were still back in Tango.
The unholstered Sin Eater in Grant's hand was a definite violation of basic security precautions. The Sin Eaters weren't equipped with safety switches, so a reflexive jerk of the finger while reviving from the transit process could result in fatal consequences for the rest of the jump team. But he knew Grant wouldn't have disobeyed the protocols unless the circumstances were extreme. He stepped aside, allowing Bridget, Grant, and Domi to exit. If any of them found his odor disagreeable, no one commented on it. In Grant's case, his sense of smell was too impaired, what with his nose broken 3 different times in the past and never properly reset.
Thank God you made it back.
Grant glared at him as he pushed his blaster back into its holster under his coat sleeve. His distrust of the Mattrans units was only a little weaker than his suspicion that Lakesh didn't know as much about them as he claimed.
We damn near didn't. The piece of shit in Minnesota malfunctioned on us.
They didn't malfunction. It functioned according to design.
How so?
Both teams tried to jump to Cerberus at nearly the same moment. I wouldn't want to contemplate the mess that would happen if the sequence is completed at the same time. The powering down of your gate is a standard failsafe developed with the prototype, a safety feature.
Wasn't safe for us. Nearly got us chilled by mags.
Mags?
Yep. A 3-man wreck squad. Lousy timing all around.
Something else, too. They accused us of assassinating Baron Ragnar.
It was more like they accused you.
Bridget's announcement put expressions of incredulity on the faces of Lakesh and Kane, as if she had announced that the nuke cost had in fact never happened.
Assassinated?
Yes, evidently by a woman. They didn't supply details. They were fused out, almost hysterical.
Now that I think about it, I get the impression they just learned about it right after they entered the redoubt.
You're right. They spotted us, but they didn't seem inclined to chase us for a few minutes. Maybe the information was relayed to them right after they saw us.
Just what went on in there?
We were there laying down fake spore. We decided to head topside for a little fresh air and almost got caught at the door. We ran for it. They saw us, but at first didn't seem like they were going to chase us. Nor did they appear agitated at all. Then, next thing we know, they went after us in a near blood rage. They screamed at us that we'd chilled the Baron. When they heard my voice, they really lost it, saying a woman had done it, and I guess they thought it was me.
A Baron hasn't been murdered since... well, never. Not since the advent of the unification program when the oligarchy was established. For that matter, I don't think a Baron has even died of natural causes.
Everyone stood silent, looking at each other. If the 9 Barons weren't immortal, they were as close as a flesh-and-blood creature could come to it. Due to their hybrid metabolisms, their longevities far exceeded those of humans. Barring accidents, illnesses, or assassinations, the Baron's lifespans could conceivably be measured by centuries. Even Lakesh wasn't certain how long they lived. But the price paid by the Barons for their extended lifespans wasn't cheap. They were fragile physically, prone to lethargy. Their vitality had to be sustained during annual visits to the Dulce installation. There, they underwent medical treatments to reverse deterioration of their mingled genetic material. The entire scope of the procedures and treatments was unknown even to Lakesh.
Bridget, you say a woman killed him?
That's what one of the mags said, or rather screamed.
Could an insurrection be brewing?
Anything is possible. But for a Baron to be murdered within his own will, presumably inside the administrative monolith, it just doesn't seem likely.
All of them understood what he meant. One of the reasons the Barons were such mysterious, awe-inspiring figures was that they rarely left their impregnable Ares. Only a month before, the deranged Baron Sharp had accompanied a magistrate squad on an incursion to Redoubt Papa. Although he had been tricked into it by a vengeance-minded counselor, circumstances put him under Kane's gun. As yet, no intel had filtered in from Sharpville indicating whether the Baron had survived the encounter.
Every defense always has a hole in it. Somebody found it, that's all. The question is who?
The other Barons won't ask that question. They already have their answer. No doubt you, Kane, and Bridget will be named as the culprits. And thus your legend grows. From turncoat seditionists to Baron Blasters.
Kane shrugged, and drops of foul-smelling water dripped from his clothing.
I don't mind taking credit for blasting a Baron.
What will happen in Ville now with Baron Childe?
As far as I know, there is no proviso for dealing with the power vacuum in the Ville chain of command. Presumably, the highest-ranking member of the Trust might assume the post temporarily, but...
You don't know?
No, I don't. I suppose, since genetic samples of all the Barons are in storage at Dulce, a duplicate of Baron Ragnar might be developed through a form of cloning. But that is only supposition.
Or the Archon Directorate might actually take an active hand.
Lakesh's usually slumped posture straightened, his roomy blue eyes glinting behind the lenses of his spectacles. He swiftly consulted his wrist chron.
The timing seems about right. It can't be a coincidence.
What can't?
About 40 minutes ago, Banks reported highly unusual behavior in Balam. My best description of it would be that Balam underwent a short period of traumatic shock.
So?
As you know, the standard theory is that Archon minds are linked in a psionic community.
A passive link. An almost subliminal awareness of one another, right? You said they would sense the absence of another mind filament. Are you suggesting that Balam reacted to the death of Baron Ragnar? But he's not an Archon, not really.
It's only one solution that fits the provisional facts, and it makes perfect sense that such a psi link would be bred into the Barons. More of a puppet string leading directly to the puppet masters than a channel of communication.
This is all very fascinating, but I think the next course of action undertaken by the Barons should concern us the most.
Kane, they may have to consult with the Directorate itself before they do anything.
If there indeed truly is such a thing.
All eyes fixed on him with intense, questioning gazes that made him realize he'd spoken that last thought out loud.
Strike that last. Yet another of my endless theories. Friend Kane, you need to visit DCAM. Dearest Bridget, there's a matter I want to discuss with you. Grant, Domi, be about your business. Welcome back, and all of that.
Taking Bridget by the elbow, Lakesh led her out of the anteroom.
He's given us our marching orders for the rest of the day. Or night.
Lakesh chose to ignore Kane as he guided Bridget out. Kane started to run his fingers through his hair and stopped when he felt the swamp-crusted mess.
Come on, Grant, Domi. Let's get out of here.
They strode through the sweeping expanse of the control complex. Bridget, Bry, and Lakesh were already huddled around a computer terminal at the far end of it, paying no attention as they passed by. Kane tried not to feel irritated. Unless risk-taking or bloodletting was pending, Lakesh often behaved as if he had no use for any of them but Baptiste. The woman could do no wrong in the old man's eyes, even though Kane knew the two had argued bitterly over matters of Cerberus policy in the recent past. Most of the time, Kane attributed Lakesh's marked favoritism for Baptiste to their long relationship in Cobaltville's historical division. Lakesh had held senior status there, and Baptiste was one of his subordinates. He had selected her to join the resistance group in the redoubt. But on occasion, their relationship seemed far deeper than that of a mentor and student. Certainly, it was not sexual in nature. It veered very close to the paternal, and was markedly different from the fondness Lakesh displayed toward Domi. Kane shrugged mentally as he, Domi, and Grant exited into the corridor.
DeFore ordered me to DCAM. What about you two?
We're clean, which can't be said for you.
That for sure. Way you smell make me homesick.
Home for Domi had been a squalid outland settlement on the banks of the Snake River in Hell's Canyon, Idaho. Kane took a strip of hanging cloth and squeezed it, wringing out a flow of rancid water. Grant and Domi made an exaggerated show of stepping around it and continuing on their way. The albino girl's unabashed devotion to Grant was the source of whispered jokes and rumors among the redoubt's personnel. She was enamored of Grant and very jealous if she perceived he paid attention to another woman, or if she suspected another woman paid attention to him. Even Kane, who had been partnered with Grant for over a dozen years, wasn't sure of the true extent and nature of their relationship. He sourly reflected that he wasn't sure of the true nature of anybody's relationship, including his and Baptiste's. The dispensary was adjacent to DCAM, so he entered to check on Rauch's condition. Only Auerbach was there, adjusting the height of one of the three examination beds. The burly, red-haired man glanced sullenly at Kane as he walked in the door.
Where's Rauch?
DeFore checked her out a few minutes ago.
She felt better then?
Suppose so.
Auerbach turned back to his work, ignoring the other man. Kane felt a flash of annoyance at the man's disinterested tone and manner, as if he begrudged every word he spoke to him. He had heard that Auerbach had an unrequited crush on Baptiste, but due to his fear of Kane, he never acted on it. And since Rauch was fairly upfront about her mission to bear Kane's child, the opportunities for the other men in Cerberus were limited. Auerbach probably felt, and justifiably, that Kane didn't deserve such an embarrassment of carnal treasures, regardless of whether he took advantage of them. Fuming mildly, Kane left and headed down the hall to DCAM. DCAM was a wide, white-tiled shower room with four partitioned cubicles. Wegman was pulling attendant duty, and he held his nose as Kane stripped off his muddy garments and dropped them in a receptacle. Standard procedure was to decontaminate clothing, too, but the balding man eyed the rags with loathing.
Surely you don't want me to keep those.
No. No more swamp dweller disguises for me. Take them down to maintenance and use them to wipe the machines.
Like hell, I'll burn them.
Kane walked nude into the shower stall, which automatically began sluicing a warm mixture of liquid disinfectant and sterilizing fluid down over him from a nozzle. The needle of the rad counter affixed to the tiled wall registered only low yellow readings. Kane massaged the DCAM stream into his body and his hair. Dark puddles of diluted mud formed at his feet, swirling down into the floor drain. He stayed beneath the shower longer than was necessary, even after the rad counter's needle flicked over into the green band. He felt more than dirty. He felt defiled, and he wanted to scrub every microscopic bit of the bayou from his pores. A hand stuck through the door, waving a shaver.
Take it. You look like you've got swamp fungus on your face.
Once 3 days' worth of beard stubble was removed, and his fingertips started to wrinkle, Kane decided he was as decontaminated as he was likely to be. Jets of cold, clear water washed over him. He felt much better when he stepped out of the cubicle, put on an absorbent robe, and started back to his quarters.
Thanks, Wegman.
You want to thank me? Never come back here like that again.
No promises.
He walked to his private quarters, a four-room suite substantially larger and better appointed than the old flat in Cobaltville's residential enclaves, which he had occupied as a magistrate. Kane walked into his bedroom and stopped short when he saw Beth Lee Rauch there. During his younger years in Cobaltville, there had been no locks on any residential doors as a matter of Ville policy, so although the door to his Cerberus living quarters had a lock, he had never acquired the habit of using it.
I knocked, but when no one answered, I took the liberty of letting myself in.
She sat on the edge of the bed, dressed in a form-fitting white bodysuit. In Rauch's case, it seemed to fit her form quite well. The zipper was open a little more than usual. He discreetly made sure his robe was closed.
I stopped at the infirmary to check on you. Auerbach said you were feeling better.
A lot better. But I'm glad you wanted to know how I am. I'm curious about something, too, and I thought I might discover the answer here.
What is it that you're curious about?
Did you really knife a slagger in the swamp?
Why do you ask?
Oh, it's a question of balance. The ebb and flow of life. Think about it. You end a life out there, and here I am, so you can start a new one.
She tossed her jet-black hair behind her shoulders and leaned forward slightly on the bed, allowing her bodysuit to give Kane the best possible view of what was being offered to him. Kane said nothing, but it required all of his self-control not to roll his eyes rudely ceilingward, not because he bore a personal grudge against Rauch. He knew why she had been brought to Cerberus. He wasn't repulsed by her. In fact, he found her quite attractive. But Lakish's interest in turning Cerberus into a breeding colony was a different matter. The totality concepts over Project Excalibur dealt with the mapping of human genomes, weeding out undesirable traits and refining useful ones. To Kane, the endless replications and variations, of which he himself had been a product through Lakish's efforts, felt sinister. Lakish's current interest in mating Kane and Rauch to improve the breed felt to Kane like a continuation of the actions that had brought about the new cost and the tyranny of the Vills. From a strictly clinical point of view, what Lakish wanted to do now made sense. To ensure that Kane's superior qualities were passed on, mating him with another woman who met all the standards of purity control was the most logical course of action. However, Kane couldn't view the situation as clinically as Lakish, or as expectantly as Rauch. Far too many emotional factors were at work.
Listen, Rauch.
Call me Beth Lee, please.
What Lakish wants is what Lakish wants. Neither one of us has to go along with it.
Oh, make no mistake. It's what I want, too.
Rauch languorously unzipped the front of her bodysuit. She wore no underclothes. Kane wasn't surprised. She stepped out of the one-piece garment and approached him with a feline grace, her smile reflecting her absolute confidence of the fact that he found her arousing. Kane couldn't help but find her slender, compact body beautiful. His gaze traveled over her firm, pear-shaped breasts with their hard, dark nipples, her flat-muscled belly and flaring hips. The dark tuft at the juncture of her thighs was a perfect triangle. She moved toward him.
Kane, it's been a long time since I had a man, and you haven't touched a woman since you arrived here.
He ruefully thought back to his brief dalliance with Morrigan aboard the Cromwell, and his even briefer encounter with the mad Fand in Ireland. Technically, Rauch was wrong, but at the moment he didn't feel inclined to correct her. What he did feel was the physical stirring that her naked proximity and her voice evoked in him. The sweat of tension formed on his body.
What makes you so sure of that?
I can see it in your eyes. You're suffering. Let me ease it.
Is it me, your assignment, or just the fact that I spilled some poor mutie's blood that's making you hot?
All three. My instincts are very good. I know men like you. Men who, by choice or necessity, spill or shed blood every day. A feast of blood makes you hungry for a dessert, Kane. You can't deny that you're hungry right now for a sweet reward like this.
Her fingers insinuated themselves under his robe, caressing his skin. Despite himself, Kane felt his body responding to her, to the sultry scent and heat radiating from her body. He had difficulty breathing. She reached up and cupped his face with her hands and stared intently into his eyes. Kane felt a yearning come upon him, a yearning he had put aside every day, every night for months. As his hands reached for her, he thought again of Morrigan and Fand, and of Baptiste. With a pang of regret that was more painful than he thought it would be, he thrust Rauch away from him. It was not easy, but it was the only thing he could do.
I don't need this complication.
What's complicated about it?
There's more to this than you could understand.
Plant your seed in me. Let me carry it. We can have fun doing it.
No.
No other woman here is suited for you.
Stop.
Baptiste can't bear your offspring even if she wanted to.
He was so occupied trying to get his body's reactions under control, Rauch's comment didn't penetrate for a moment. Then his fingers tightened on her bare shoulders.
Oh!
What did you mean by
that? Kane, are you there?
The Cerberus transcom channels were voice activated, and Rauch knew it. She turned her head toward it with a smirk.
He's busy. Leave us alone.
You little bitch. What is it, Baptiste?
We found something that might have bearing on Baron Ragnar's assassination. It'll keep until you're not busy.
I'll be there in a couple of minutes.
Take your time. I want to change clothes and have a bite to eat.
Rauch looked up at him with a smugly triumphant smile.
Well, now that she's given you her permission, why don't we get on with it? We can take just as long as you want. We're in the right place for it.
You're not. Get out.
Under the icy intensity of Kane's eyes, her smile faltered, then left her lips.
That's not what I thought.
Get dressed and go. Or don't get dressed and go. Either way, go.
Bending down, he snatched up her bodysuit and flung it at her. She caught it, anger flaring in her eyes and twisting her features.
You'll regret this, Kane.
Be careful what you say, Rauch. Almost everyone else who's directed that lousy cliche at me took the last train west.
For an instant, Rauch appeared confused, not understanding the old Deathlands jargon. When she grasped the context, she hugged her clothing tightly and took a step backward. Her sudden fear seemed a little exaggerated.
Are you threatening me? I'll tell Lakesh.
I'm not threatening you. And there's no need for you to tell Lakesh. I'll speak to him myself. And I'll tell him this. If he wants Cerberus to become a breeding colony, that's his business. But participation is voluntary. If I want my seed spread, I'll be the one to decide when and who carries it. Not him and not you.
There are other men here, Kane. I'll visit one of them.
As she stalked out of the bedroom, Kane watched the arrogant sway of her lovely backside. He wondered if she would get dressed before leaving his quarters. The sound told him she hadn't bothered. Domi had been known to stroll nude through the redoubt, so if Rauch wanted to do the same, it wasn't without precedent. Kane suspected that she hoped to run into Bridget somewhere in the corridor. Kane went to the closet and removed a bodysuit from a hanger. A bit surprised, he felt very little genuine anger toward Rauch, and what he felt toward Lakesh on this matter was more of a clash of principles. The cooperation among the Cerberus exiles was only a spoken agreement. There were no formal oaths or vows like the ones he and Grant had taken upon admission into the Magistrate Division. There were, of course, security protocols to be observed, and certain assigned duties that had to be performed, but anything other than those was a matter of persuasion and volunteerism. There was no system of penalties or punishments if cooperation was not given. Kane had simply not volunteered to take part in Lakesh's breeding plan. Still, he wondered why he had felt a certain twinge at Rauch's statement about other men. Shortly after the lifting of a frosty dawn, the storm moved into Ragnarville. Ice storms with 250-mile-per-hour winds once roared out of Canada, and toxic, acidic rains used to lash the landscape with a seasonal frequency. The after-effects of Skydark still lingered in some regions. Though weather patterns could only be counted on to be capricious, this storm was different. A mountainous thunderhead skimmed out of the north on a direct course with the Ville, blotting out the sky above the spire of the administrative monolith. The floating, billowing mass thickened rapidly, casting a deep shadow over the entire perimeter of Ragnarville, bringing a sudden and oppressive gloom. The atmospheric pressure seemed to increase, pressing against eardrums, making respiration labored. Down in the Tartarus pits, eyes still blurred from sleep turned upward from the muddy streets to watch the stormy blackness slowly lowering and spreading like a blanket. Strange luminescence flashed within its roiling center like arcs of heat lightning. A hollowly booming thunderclap made the ramshackle buildings tremble. The underside of the cloud surged out, belling downward. From this sparked glowing motes, showering down like a glittering snow flurry. As the motes fell, tiny whistling noises cut through the chill air. Black-rimmed holes appeared in the white rock creek facade of the monolith, little curls of smoke rising from them. A pit dweller dropped to his knees on the sludge-covered lane, clawing at his face, smoke wisping from the black, empty socket of his right eye. People stampeded for shelter, jerking with the impact of the tiny, glowing drops. As the drops fell, they became globules, hissing and sending up clouds of steam as they struck the wet streets. Flames exploded on the dry-rotted roofs of some of the older squats. Crowds herded to any cover they could find, the panicky crush a near riot. Children were bowled off their feet, trampled and kicked as the air fogged with the falling fiery globules. A thread of writhing white fury emerged from the boiling center of the cloud and caressed the exterior of the administrative monolith between levels A and B. Several square yards of rockcrete erupted from its columnar surface, the glass panes in two of the slit-shaped windows bursting inward. The storm slowly began to drift away from Ragnarville, nudged by the wind. On level C of the monolith, a wide, square section of the facade rose. As it ascended, giant, groaning gears and squealing pulleys extended a long, flat slab like a metal-riveted, squared-off tongue. Three deathbirds rested upon it, secured by cables attached to eye bolts sunk deep in the slab. All three of the helicopters were sleek, compact, and streamlined, painted a matte finish, non-reflective black. The curving forward ports were tinted in smoky hues. The metal-sheathed stub wings carried 32 57mm unguided missiles, two full pods to a wing. Multi-barreled 50-caliber miniguns protruded from chin turrets beneath the cockpits. Mechs scurried out of the cavernous opening on the side of the tower, unhooking the cables from the landing skids on the center deathbird. Two black-armored magistrates, a pilot and his gunner, climbed into the cockpit and keyed the engine to life. The rotor blades whirled into a hazy circle. The aircraft lifted from the pad, turned, and streaked over the walls in pursuit of the cloud. It reached the trailing edge of the dark mass and cut a circling course around it. The chopper suddenly swerved as if caught in a blast of wind sweeping out of the Thunderhead. Bucking up and down, wobbling to and fro, the pilot fought the controls, attempting to level off the Deathbird and move away from the cloud at the same time. For a long span of seconds, the aircraft seemed to hang, floating suspended in the sky. Then, with a whine of overstressed engines, it managed to bank swiftly away. Ascending at a sharp angle, it leveled off 100 feet above the cloud and assumed a hovering position. Crooked flares of white lightning erupted out of the top layer of the cloud formation. They whiplashed around the belly of the Deathbird, and for an instant, a skein of electricity danced over the fuselage. The helicopter plunged straight down, tumbling into the Thunderhead itself. It vanished, swallowed up by the billowing darkness. When the Deathbird reappeared, it was tearing through the bottom layer of the cloud formation, spilling downward in a wild, gyrating spin. The portside stub wing buckled back as it spiraled down, tail assembly grotesquely pointing at the underside of the cloud, foreport on a direct vertical line with the ground. It plunged to the horizon. The terrified onlookers assembled at the open hangar door, staring at the distant wreck of the Deathbird.
Arch, what could have done that? Lightning that strikes up? It's like the cloud...
Cloud was like what, Royce?
Like nothing, sir.
Go ahead, speak.
Like the storm was intelligent, or controlled.
A hard, humorless half-smile quirked the corner of Barch's mouth as he glanced back outside, then at Royce.
Do you think that's possible?
I don't know. I didn't think it was possible for the Baron to be fried in his bed either. Maybe there's a connection. Maybe the villa's cursed.
He broke off, realizing he was voicing private fears and how foolish they sounded. He waited for a stern rebuke from Barch, but it didn't come.
All right, get this pad retraced. Close the hangar bay doors. You, dispatch a squad to the crash site. Move!
Royce watched him and listened to his commanding tone, and he wondered, just for a moment, why Barch had ordered the bird flyover of a storm, and why he didn't appear more distraught about the loss of one of the rare aircraft, not to mention a pair of highly trained bird jockeys. Neither the Deathbirds nor the men who knew how to fly them were commonplace. But because now Barch claimed to be in command of Ragnarville, no one questioned him. Certainly none of the other division administrators had lodged objections to his assumption of authority. They were relieved someone had. As the huge hangar door rumbled down, Barch imperiously gestured for Royce to follow him as he walked through the cavernous bay. They passed the two Deathbirds remaining in Ragnarville's fleet and exited into the main corridor. Royce trailed Barch past the office suites, training rooms, and the intel section. When they entered Royce's small, oval-shaped office, Barch took the chair behind the desk. He waved him to the only other chair, and without an option, Royce sat.
I'm appointing you Magistrate Division Administrator.
Royce's mind froze in stunned disbelief. True, he had reached the age where the mandatory transfer to an administrative position was pending, but to be given the power and responsibility over the entire division wasn't a promotion he had ever dreamed could happen. On reflection, he wasn't certain if he wanted it to happen.
Sir, you're the administrator.
As of today, I'm relinquishing that post and assuming authority over Ragnarville and its territory. You're one of my own, Royce, and I need one of my own to take over as administrator. I don't trust anyone else.
Is this only a temporary arrangement, sir?
Temporary?
Until a new Baron is named.
For all intents and purposes, I am the new Baron. Wouldn't you agree?
Royce's shocked mind wheeled with questions, alarm, and conjecture. All he really knew about the Barons was that they were part of an oligarchy, elevated and removed from the common human herd. For a man he had known for years, a man he respected as intelligent, resourceful, to proclaim himself Baron smacked of heresy. Barch, for all of his gifts and abilities, was still only a human like himself. Royce's shocked silence made the grin disappear from Barch's face.
Wouldn't you agree?
I would.
Barch continued to stare at him, his cyclopean gaze unblinking and menacing. Royce groped for the right words.
My Lord Baron.
Of course I don't expect you to address me that way in public, at least not right away. First things first, I want you to select a dozen of the bravest and brightest from the division ranks. Are all of our officers accounted for?
All but three, Hadley, Brewer, and Arnhem. As per your orders, I sent them to wreck the readout where they encountered two, possibly three intruders. One was a woman.
Barch's eye flickered with a fleeting, indefinable emotion before his face locked in a tight, grim mask.
Outlanders, probably.
No, sir. One of them chilled Arnhem. According to the radio report I received, he was chilled with a Sin Eater.
Barch's reaction wasn't what Royce expected. The grim mask of his face didn't alter.
Were the intruders apprehended?
Royce fidgeted in his chair, not knowing how or even wanting to answer the question.
Permission to speak freely?
Proceed.
According to Brewer and Hadley, the intruders escaped by a means they could not understand, or even really describe in a way that made sense. If I hadn't seen you step out of that armiglass chamber on Level A, I wouldn't have known what they were talking about.
A gateway unit. You and your wreck squad saw something not meant to be seen by uninitiated eyes.
Royce uneasily recalled Barch's recriminations to Walsh only a few hours ago about the violation of protocol. At the time, he didn't know what he meant, but now a fearful understanding crept into his mind.
Fortunately for you, as administrator of the division, you will be initiated.
The intruders had something to do with the Baron's death, or they were the assassins themselves. I ordered Hadley and Brewer to remain there until further notice. They have 2 days' worth of rations in the wag.
Under the circumstances, you made the correct decision. However, I don't think the intruders in the redoubt need concern us over much. If they are part of a larger conspiracy to overthrow Ragnarville, they're only pawns.
A conspiracy?
What else could it be? The Baron and one of his guardsmen murdered? A bizarre storm? None of these events can be coincidental. That's why I want the formation of a task force, so we can not only ferret out the conspirators that may be in our midst, but also to act immediately if and when another assault comes our way. They don't have to be blooded hard contact mags, but I prefer that they are. I also need a half dozen tech heads. The higher the seniority, the better. After you've made your choices, send their psych profiles to me for review.
You suspect traitors in Ragnarville?
An inside job is the only explanation. A small handful of seditionists within the Ville are colluding with the preservationists.
Every mag in every Ville knew about the preservationists. They had served as a culprit for a variety of crimes for decades, a shadowy menace drifting in and out of the baronies like smoke.
I understand. How soon do you need the profiles?
I needed them about 3 weeks ago. I'll settle for 2 hours from now.
Barch heaved himself out of the chair. Royce stood up as Barch moved around the desk. Barch clapped him on the shoulder as he walked to the door.
The next few days will be tough, but if you believe in me, I promise you the rewards will be more than worth it.
Royce waited until Barch strode into the corridor. The door closed.
That's what the fuck I'm afraid of.
Lakesh leaned back in his chair, staring at the VGA monitor screen.
We've discovered something.
Kane waited. He looked over to Bry, who was hunched over a computer terminal on the far side of the control complex, then cast his eyes over to Grant. He saw the mental shrug in his otherwise expressionless eyes. Apparently, Grant was going to remain quiet and let Lakesh move forward with his discovery when the old man was good and ready. Kane was not so patient.
Discovered what? Baptiste said you'd come across something that might connect to Baron Ragnar's death.
I'll explain in a moment, friend Kane. As soon as Bridget arrives, we'll hold a full briefing.
As Lakesh spoke the last word of the sentence, Bridget walked in with her characteristic mannish stride. The few wisps of her red-gold hair escaping the severe bun at the back of her skull were the only evidence she'd been hurrying. She had changed into a bodysuit that clung in all the right places to her tall, willowy body. She wore the badge of her former office as an archivist, a pair of wire-rimmed, rectangular-framed spectacles.
You're late.
Bridget ignored him, keeping her attention on the seated Lakesh.
Sorry I'm late, Lakesh.
Nonsense. You're right on time. For a change, friends Kane and Grant were early.
Bridget cast a cool glance toward Kane.
I told you to take your time. I figured you and Rauch would be busy for a while.
Look, Baptiste, there was nothing going on with Rauch.
Yes, well, perhaps later you and Bridget can discuss your differing interpretations of busy. At the moment, there is something else to consider.
Kane waited for the cadaverous man to reveal the reason the three of them had been summoned to the control center.
So what's wrong up there?
Where?
There at the upper corner of the Mercator map, in Alaska.
Kane felt as though he and Grant were both unruly students trapped in some god-awful geography class, with Baptiste standing tall and proud as the teacher's pet. Grant frowned at the winking light that was alternating between the colors of amber and green.
There's a problem in Redoubt Zulu?
Of a sort. In some ways, more of a mystery, but it could have a promising, perhaps even beneficial solution.
How so?
As we know, someone visited the redoubt some 3 weeks ago. Only a couple of hours ago, coinciding with the alleged murder of Baron Ragnar and Balaam's outburst, the sensors registered new activity on the Matran's jump lines. A DMAT and a MAT.
Seems like more and more people are becoming aware of what was once a secret method of getting around.
All of the barons are aware of the units, and in order to carry out searches, others must be informed. Such is the way. And sometimes, perhaps, abusing those secrets is also the way.
Is there anything in that redoubt worth abusing? According to the intel you pulled from the database, it was built to be a stockpile, and it was cleaned out during unification.
We performed a deeper, more comprehensive search using other keywords. From the classified information we've been able to access from the database, Redoubt Zulu has served as a primary HARP installation.
Kane and Grant stiffened at the mention of the word HARP. The word held unpleasant connotations for them, instantly bringing to mind their painful encounters with infrasound weapons in the shape of the musical instruments.
HARP. Did I hear you right?
Obviously, HARP is an acronym, Kane. It's got nothing to do with the Danann or Martian trolls.
That's good to know, Baptiste. I was afraid we might have to hang up our blasters and go out into the field armed with flugelhorns.
He hated himself for being baited, and hated himself even more for raising his voice when he snapped back at her.
HARP is indeed an acronym. It stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program.
Which still tells me nothing.
That makes two of us.
Allow me to enlighten you. After all, that is the reason for a briefing session, is it not?
Lakesh clicked a small switch on the tabletop, which caused the 4-foot-square VGA monitor screen to flare into life. On it appeared a pre-dark map of the most northward addition to the United States, the landmass of Alaska.
During the early part of the 90s, a decade or so before the nuclear conflagration, the HARP facility was assembled on a military base in Alaska. This was a joint project between the Air Force and the Navy, at least a joint project for cover story purposes. In actuality, the United States was working closely with a Russian team, who had their own version of HARP, known as Sura.
Once a pissing contest, always a pissing contest.
Quite the vulgar metaphor, friend Kane, but also quite true. HARP had several parts, most interesting being the IRI, or Ionospheric Research Instrument. At the time of its construction, the IRI was the largest high-frequency radio transmitter ever built.
Purpose being communications?
Not exactly. It was designed to concentrate several thousand megawatts into an intense beam of almost unimaginable strength, transmitted through miles of planar antenna arrays on the shortwave band.
And then?
HARP was able to facilitate enormous changes to the upper atmosphere with a focused and steerable electromagnetic beam, generating enormously high degrees of heat. In fact, according to the documentation of the time, HARP was better known and described as being an ionospheric heater.
A heater.
Grant cast an incredulous look at Kane. Lakesh caught the eye exchange and frowned impatiently.
Of the ionosphere, yes. Almost a reversal of what a radio telescope is. The HARP antennae send out signals instead of receiving, and their destination is very close to home.
So the ionosphere is what, part of the atmosphere? What's this thing good for? Heating up cold spots or something?
Both Kane and Grant were far from being dense, but parts of Lakesh's dissertation landed in dead zones in their limited educations.
Close, friend Kane. The ionosphere is the electrically charged sphere surrounding Earth's upper atmosphere. The ionosphere is an active electrical shield, protecting our planet from the constant bombardment of high-energy particles from space. Working in conjunction with the Earth's magnetic field, all sorts of harmful types of cosmic radiation are prevented from coming down below. Usually, the ionosphere is approximately 40 to 60 miles above the surface of the planet, keeping the danger away. However, full activation of the HARP project would have brought this much closer to home, and as such, was considered fair game for the military. The former Department of Defense believed that the HARP project would give them incredible means of communication far beyond their current capabilities.
All of this talk reminds me of a banned book I once read during a slow moment in the Cobaltville archives. A man named Gordon J.F. MacDonald wrote and published a book entitled Unless Peace Comes.
Ah, Professor MacDonald. I met him once. Back in the 1960s, he was associate director of the Institute of Geophysics and Planetary Physics at the University of California. He was quite keen on the use of environmental control technologies for military purposes. Hadn't thought about the fellow in years, but now you've jogged my memory.
There was a chapter in his book called How to Wreck the Environment. He described something similar to HARP and how it could be used to affect and control the weather, climate modification, polar ice cap melting or destabilization, ozone depletion techniques, earthquake engineering, ocean wave control, and even brainwave manipulation using the Earth's energy fields.
There you have it. Lakesh leaned back in his chair and folded his arms over his chest.
Well, if this HARP thing can do all of that, why wasn't it ever used?
Who's to say it wasn't? I imagine it was buried under the usual reams of paperwork and misinformation. Unlike the Totality Concept projects, which none but politicians and military personnel with the highest classifications were aware of, HARP was an open book, at least superficially. The more informed public minds knew it was there, and it scared the hell out of them. But since the military had taken great pains to hide the secret in plain sight, not much was ever accomplished.
The purloined letter principle.
The reference was lost on Kane and Grant, but Lakesh smiled appreciatively.
Just so. My theory is that while the capabilities of the HARP installation might have been tested in some degrees, the full capability of the antenna array was never fully utilized. There wasn't enough time, lack of funds, and lack of time.
So it wasn't part of the Totality Concept?
No. The scientific background of HARP predated the Totality Concept by decades.
As he rapidly typed a few commands on the keyboard of the terminal before him, the screen cleared of the Alaskan map, and a photograph replaced it. It was the image of a man with a mustache and hairstyle that hadn't been worn in over 300 years. The man seemed bemused, looking off-camera at something only he could see. From the black-and-white tones of the photo, the period dress, and the man's appearance, Kane knew he looked at someone dead long before the nuke cost.
Nikola Tesla. Arguably the greatest inventor who ever lived. He shares credit with his student Marconi for the invention of radio, and he also discovered alternating current. Back in 1899, Tesla built a transmitting tower on top of a Colorado mountain as his first experiment in utilizing the electromagnetic radiation of Earth to provide a free energy source. His intent was to use the Earth as a huge resonant system. His writings contain references to the terrestrial stationary waves, a resonant excitation of the ground, a magnetosphere, or even a wave guide between the two. Tesla boasted that he'd done this on a trial scale, using super-powerful magnifying transformers like his tower in Colorado. Around 1901, Tesla proposed his world system. Specifically, Tesla anticipated very low-frequency global navigation, radar, Morse telegraphy, with ships at sea, multiplexing, remote-controlled weapons, and pretty much the rest of the terrestrial postmodern technosphere.
Did any of this really work?
20th-century conspiracy theorists claimed Tesla's wireless power distribution actually worked too well. It's one of those great, unprovable Frankenstein tales, half anti-government paranoia, half fear of science.
Assuming Redoubt Zula was part of the HARP project, and assuming someone is visiting it, why is that supposed to concern us? Even if the antenna array still exists, so what if it's put back online?
If the apparatus for the HARP is still operable, it will function like the reversal of the old radio telescopes. It focuses a giant gigawatt electromagnetic beam on the ionosphere, which bounces back to Earth and penetrates everything. The reflected beam can travel along the planet's magnetic mantle, and the impulses will vibrate geomagnetic flux lines. If aimed and pulsed with the proper precision, you'd have an instant earthquake.
Or the lower atmosphere can be disrupted to create weather from hell of the likes not seen since Skydark.
Weather control?
Weather warfare. For decades, the Department of Defense developed methods to manipulate storms in projects Skyfire and Storm Fury. In 1994, they announced a master weather control program called Spacecast 2020. Is it a coincidence this program dovetailed with the completion of the HAARP installation? I don't think so.
There's more to it than that.
Isn't there always?
Pulsed radio frequency radiation, the very stuff HAARP is based on, can disturb and manipulate human mental processes. In other words, mind control. Electromagnetic waves can produce mild to severe physiological disruption or perceptual distortion.
All right. You've convinced me that HAARP could be put to destructive uses. I'm still waiting to be convinced that this somehow connects to Baron Ragnar's death and the activity at Redoubt Zulu's MAT-TRANS unit.
I don't believe in coincidence, friend Grant. Baron Ragnar's apparent assassination at the hands of parties unknown, coming on the heels of transit path traffic to and from Zulu, a redoubt under Ragnarville's jurisdiction, points to something other than mere happenstance. It demands investigation.
The last time we investigated activity in a redoubt, we ended up on Mars.
I can't offer absolute assurance that you won't visit another celestial body, but I can assure you that the implications of an operational HAARP are worse than dire.
Hell, you say that about every op you plan for us.
And have they not been so? Or sometimes worse than I initially outlined?
Kane mentally reviewed all the prior ops he, Bridget, and Grant had performed since arriving at Cerberus. Grudgingly but silently, he admitted the old man was right.
Perhaps we have some recent satellite pics of Redoubt Zulu's region. That might give us an idea of anything going on there.
Mr. Bry is working on that now. However, our first step in the investigation isn't Alaska, it's Ragnarville. Friend Kane, friend Grant, you need to go there.
Kane and Grant stared at him as if he had suddenly gone insane.
Oh no, no way.
Grant and I are criminals, remember? We're wanted in all the Vills, and we're suspected of chilling Baron Ragnar.
If we want to know more details about the assassination, what better place to find out than in the Vill itself? And who better to ask the questions than a pair of magistrates?
What better place to stumble around, get made, and get chilled, more likely?
You walk the walk and talk the talk. Go in, be discreet, and get out.
How do you expect us to get there so we can walk the walk and talk the talk? We'll have to jump to Redoubt Tango, and it's, what, Bridget, 30 miles from the Vill?
Yes, a long way to walk the walk this time of year that far north.
More than likely, guards have been posted at the redoubt since your encounter. If so, they have a vehicle you can commandeer.
If so, the guards will blow us to itty-bitty pieces as soon as we step out of the jump chamber.
Not if you step out as Ragnarville magistrates. They'll challenge you, certainly, but just say, Barch sent us.
Barch? Isn't he their division administrator?
Though all the Vills and their respective divisions operated independently of one another, there was still an exchange of information about personnel between them, particularly so in the Mag divisions.
If nothing else, invoking his name will buy you some time to either bluff your way through or overpower the opposition.
No need to pretty it up. You mean chill them.
Kane and Grant stiffened at the euphemism. Although both men were uncomfortably aware that terminate-on-site warrants had been issued against them, directing violence against members of their former brotherhood still caused them pangs of guilt. They retained vivid memories of the firefight with Cobaltville mags when they made their escape. Neither man relished them.
I meant overpower. There are a few non-lethal weapons in the armory.
Grant thought of the Cerberus arsenal, with its number of subguns, semi-automatic pistols, explosives, bazookas, tripod-mounted M249 machine guns, and grenade launchers.
There are?
Admittedly, only a few. They would not have been much use to you on your previous field trips.
What if there are no guards and no means of transportation to Ragnarville?
In that eventuality, return here. Cerberus can't afford your absence for the length of time it would take you to hoof it to the Vill.
But it can afford our absence if we make it there and are captured and chilled?
In that case, at least your fates will be in the line of duty. You should find some comfort in that.